Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Hi. In today's episode of the podcast, we will be reflecting on the 2011 Egyptian Revolution, and our guest today is my dear friend and colleague, Manal Hamzi. Manal Hamzi is a full professor of gender and sexualities in the Department of Interdisciplinary Studies at New Mexico State University. Her teaching and research draw on anti-racist educational theories and decolonial feminist research methodologies. During her time at NMSU, she had been honored with 3 teaching awards. Manal's research is distinguished by being transnational in scope, being intimately collaborative, and using arts-based qualitative methodologies. Her research has made a significant contribution to the contemporary fields of Arabia and Chicana decolonizing feminist methodologies. She has also made an impact in the fields of Arab feminisms, women's studies, and sports sociology. Her scholarship has wide-reached, notably for popular audiences eager to access anti-Orientalist perspectives about Arabs and Muslims. Her research has an international reach, having been published in journals based in North America, the UK, Egypt, and elsewhere. Manal is the author of Women Resisting Sexual Violence and the Egyptian Revolution, Arab Feminist Testimonies, Pedagogies of Devailing, and the co-author of the short animation film The Four Hijabs, a collaborative work with playwright Jamil Khoury of Chicago Silk Road Rising Theater. Manal earned a PhD in social justice education from the New Mexico State University in 2007, and she's a second-generation Palestinian born in Jordan. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Manal. It's such a pleasure, and I'm so, so thrilled to be in conversation with you.
Well, thank you, Chani. I'm also honored and thrilled to be with you and to be talking about this long journey with the book and people who made it happen for the first time. It's my first public appearance on it, and I appreciate that, especially because we're in this pandemic being separated from each other. I think this is a continuation of our collaboration as colleagues, and so I really thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Of course. Well, before we begin our conversation, Manal, I just wanted to give folks a little bit of some background context on what we're going to be speaking about. So today's episode on this January 25th, 2021, will mark 10 years since the Egyptian Revolution, or what the Egyptians call Sawaret Yaniyat, that erupted in Tahrir Square in Cairo following the uprisings in Tunisia in 2011. The revolution was a monumental popular uprising that emerged as a response to the economic crisis, government corruption, high unemployment, lack of minimum wage, police brutality, inadequate healthcare, the oligarchy of then President Hosni Mubarak, and ties of the state to imperialist forces. The images that were coming out of Egypt and especially Tahrir in 2011 were astounding and inspiring as millions were in the streets demanding bread, freedom, and justice, and the fall of the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak, and was later replaced by authoritarian regimes. Some of the most horrifying images that came out during this period were images of security forces attacking protesters, particularly women, many who were sexually assaulted and raped either in broad daylight or in the state's prisons. State-sanctioned violence against women was meant to deter them from taking part in the protests in the streets, repressing dissent, and also intimidating women's political activity more broadly. But as we saw, women continued to play a defiant role in the revolution. While there were many hopes for change, that dream remains elusive. Manal, your latest book, Women Resisting Sexual Violence and the Egyptian Revolution, focuses on the testimonies of women that participated in the revolution, their experiences of sexual violence, and refutes Western imperialist feminist narratives about the revolution. You were in the streets sometime after, as the uprisings continued to take place, and had the opportunity to speak with and build relationships with many feminists in the Egyptian women's and feminist movement. and document some of the experiences which the book theorizes to show how women's experiences have shaped gender relations in Egypt and the Arab world. So to begin, can you take us back to that period and speak to what inspired your work on women's resistance in the revolution?
Yes. So if we go back to at the beginning of 2011, we need to also look back to the previous 10 years after 9/11 and the invasion of American invasion of Iraq, and the protests all over the Arab world against that occupation and assault to Iraq and the Iraqis. So movements, labor movements, were building up protesting against the new liberalism and militarism and police brutality within Egypt 10 years before the 2011 revolution. Mm-hmm. So I'm mentioning this because I want to say that 2011, the January 25th, 2011 revolution, Sawrat Yanayir, did not come from a vacuum, and it's not only a kind of a superficial response to the Tunisian revolution a month before that, or the Sahrawi revolution in 2010. So things tipped after the police brutality was shown on videos circulated on social media, and the buildup was on different levels in Egypt, within the labor movement, within the movement, women and feminist movements, within other political parties on the ground. So it's a buildup of at least 20 years. And we need to also mention that the 2011 Egyptian revolution is not one in those past 100 years. There were many revolutions since the British colonization of Egypt. So we need to emphasize that the Egyptians have been in a mode of revolution for over 100 years, but this one we have seen intensively through social media and live, often in the first 18 days at least of the protests in the streets in Egypt. So this is a little bit of how the period or the revolution came to the surface in 2011. But to speak about how I was inspired to do the work with the women resisting in the revolution, I need to also preface this by situating myself and presenting my layered positionalities in this work and as an academic. I consider myself, of course, an Arab feminist, Arabiya, Nasawiya, Arabiya. And that my first language is Arabic. And I came to the North American Academy sort of late, in my early 40s, and was constantly up against imperial feminism. Mm. And having no tools to figure out how to counter them or go beyond them. So it took a few years, and I think the inspiration of me naming methodologies, naming Arabiya epistemologies, were coming from the work and the theorizing of women in Egypt on the ground in this revolution. Having said that, I am an academic that continues to cross bridges between languages and geographical spaces, and also epistemologies that can be bridged. Mm. And I'm not talking about bridging, of course, with the imperial feminist epistemologies, but that of Chicana's epistemologies, which is evident in the throughout the book. The moment of inspiration for this book, it could not have been avoided in some ways, because many of us Arabs and non-Arabs who are revolutionaries, who are in solidarities with people rising against colonialism and militarism, have seen the moment visually, and it made me feel that I am coming back home in some ways. And Egypt is, though I was born in Jordan and I'm second generation Palestinian, Egypt is also a home for me. I've spent a lot of time in my childhood and later in my 20s in Egypt working. So it is a place that is familiar. The people, the use of colloquial Egyptian in art and in literature is inside me. Mm-hmm. So inspiration was also visceral, seeing not only women being beaten up, but also all genders being abused and oppressed to counter the revolution. So those 18 days in January and February until the toppling of Mubarak were very inspirational. Mm. And then going there in December of 2011 and being on the ground and beginning to converse and connect with the activists on the ground, and then seeing images of women being beaten and basically dragged and stripped in public, was the spark of like, I am hearing those testimonies, their shahadat, and I need to figure out what they mean within this moment and beyond.
So actually, speaking of shahadat, in the book, you were able to document the narratives of women who participated in the revolution and who experience some of the most horrific forms of state sanctioned violence upon them, and two main decolonial, or as you call Arabia, methodologies that you use were shahadat and haki to validate the lived experiences and epistemologies of historically oppressed groups in order to recenter women's long positions and practices in continuous revolutions in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world. So can you explain to listeners how you conceptualize shahadat and haki and what this methodology really has allowed you to do?
Let's first break down the word shahadat and haki in Arabic. And shahadat comes from the verb shahada, and that means witnessed. And though it is used as a noun in the masculine form throughout, in all dictionaries and in even in courts, but they are also not used in the public realm, but they've become prominent in this revolution. Mm. They would, Egyptians would hold, rallies and go by one by one on the microphone and speaking their shahadat on what happened to them on this day and that day. Mm. So it's become a tool for them that it became part of the revolution, though before it was only within the court system. And then I would say that it is it comes along. I asserted it in Arabic because I wanted to speak with and bridge with the Chicana testimonial literature on testimonials as epistemologies and methodologies and method at the same time. Mm-hmm. So because I collaborate with Chicanas feministas here on the borderlands, it became apparent that I need to speak it out in Arabic and make the connection that we're all in that kind of in that struggle, anti-colonial, anti-militarist, and anti-patriarchal struggle. Haki, I think, has been mentioned already by several Palestinian and Arab feminists, including Fayha Abdel Hadi, who speaks of it as one of the tools that Palestinians use to re-narrate their stories of oppression that comes within the historical context of the Zionist settler colonial oppression to the Palestinians in their stolen land and outside. So haki means also comes from the verb that weaves. So it is about witnessing and speaking the truth and being even a prophet, meaning the messenger of the truth that is about deception and has to happen also publicly. Mm. So, and it has a political intention. So anybody of those women who I represent in the book are intentionally divulging the truth about the oppressive experience that they had in public, and they have a political intention to expose and quote unquote also shame the regimes that violated their bodies, and turning the tables against those regimes because they tried to shame women, trying to use all sorts of call them cultural, traditional ways of looking, patriarchal ways of looking at women's bodies. So those, the Shahadat themselves, textually or orally, were present on social media. But they became to me the prompt to begin relationships with a few of those women, to begin conversing haki, doing the casual haki with trust and in spaces of vulnerability, so that they can say more, divulge more about the details that they've put aside or didn't express at the moment or right after the experience. So haki and shahadat, they are like sort of multi-layered and cyclical spiral kind of methodology that allows us to go deeper and deeper in visceral bodily experiences of violence, especially with those women. And this also brings the fact that this process brought me and the three specific women that I worked with into a space of making sense and remaking sense, which is theorizing what is that experience. And that takes a long time and definitely takes trust, and the making sense of the experience has to become visceral because you're talking about bodily violence.
Of course, yeah.
It cannot be separated. So yes, I'm not neutral. Yes, I'm not objective, of course. But that relationships allows us to check in with each other and do the reflection, the self-critical reflexivity together, to see if the meaning we're portraying, we're representing, whether in this book or later in other forms, is what they meant to express and they want and they have an intention with to make the change. So, but also asserting that this has become an part of one of many Arab feminist methodologies of knowing, and I don't want to call it research. Okay, and oral history has been used all along and as a methodology, but I think this has been overlooked, and I want to just uplift it to see how that could be one of the methodologies that works in collaborations with people that we are seeking to understand their experiences as they teach us along the way, more than what we know, of course, and have them understand with us that we are not coming in to extract anything from them, but to make sense of what they have already theorized and elevated and represented somehow and disseminated somewhere in this world.
Precisely. So in the book, you describe four state-sanctioned tactics of sexual violence against women, which include virginity inspections or exposures, beating, dragging, stripping, stomping, organized mob rapes, and detaining, beating, and sexual assault. And you specifically talk about how each one of these tactics was distinct. Each tactic was linked to an apparatus of power and to particular groups who implemented the sexual assaults, whether that be military forces, regular police, secret police, state hired thugs, or Islamist militias. And so, you know, can you speak and explain this a bit further, and also talk about how Egyptian women's bodies were weaponized by the state during the revolution? And if you can give us some examples beyond the sort of description I've provided here.
Right. To put this in context, again, all those shahadat that we're discussing, and they are in the book, came and the experiences of women of the state-sanctioned violence came right after the toppling of Hosni Mubarak. So when the 18 days were over and it was thought that, oh, the Egyptian people have won, but with U.S. help, the military took over.
Right.
As an interim force to keep the country stable and then move into elections. And so that was the period when the virginity test started to happen under the watch and under the orders of the military and under the specific orders of the current president of Egypt right now, Abdel Fattah Sisi. And then the period after that was after the elections when Mohamed Morsi was elected as president. So the Islamists took over and their apparatuses, their militias started to also work against the revolution and its forces and its participants after the June 2011. Or 2012, right? So it came, those assaults happened in different eras, one under the militarist and one under the Islamist. And though we think that the police has changed, of course, it was the same apparatus, military or police forces, and beside the Islamist militias, they were targeting women, basically, because they are more than 50% of the population. They've been visible on the forefronts, and that's not new to Egyptian women. Let's not reinforce Western feminist narratives that, oh, it's the first time that women come out of this patriarchal society and rebel. And they've been on the forefronts and they were visible, so they were obvious targets. That's one. And the counter-revolutionary forces thought that if they come at women, they could shame the men in the society and they will pull them, so to speak, back home. And that didn't work. So this is the biggest argument of the resistance of those women. They resisted patriarchy, however it manifested itself within the regime's apparatuses and within the family and the public sphere. Within political parties even. So those were attempts, those were kinds of violence that were coming out to counter the revolution. And we should emphasize here also that they've been also used against other genders, men included. So it is not only against women, but in this book, I am centering it on women for all sorts of reasons. And it is clear that the regimes that took over are against the revolution. So they had to find a way, even though they were in a democracy that was supported by the US. We know what that means. It means they took over that people's revolution and they tried to stop it. But I also argue in the book that the revolution is continuing on different levels, in different forms, even though we don't see it in the streets in the form of protests.
So, you know, you have included the stories of these powerful women who have, you know, the utmost, the spirit of Sumud, you know, steadfastness and defiance and resistance that, of course, a lot of women embody, but there is a particular also sense of strength and courage as they have, you know, not only spoken out against it, but have enabled documentation and an ongoing sort of process of documentation and having that work be, you know, spread through either the book or through, you know, the graphic illustrations that are part of your work. And so I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the three women that are part of this book, and perhaps briefly, because I think it might be useful at a later time to really explore more fully who they are, but perhaps briefly, if you can tell us about the testimonies that were included in this book.
The first testimony and the first shahida, the testimony lita, Samira Ibrahim, is a public figure. She came out against the military when they forced her and basically raped her to inspect her virginity, so to speak. And she is from Sohaj, a rural area, a fierce young woman in her 20s, and who just wanted justice and dignity in Egypt. Mm. And then she found herself into this battle against the military and took them to court. And then the second one was Yasmin Barmawi, who is a musician, part of who lives in Cairo and was on the streets and was attacked at the time when they were having the Million People's Marches after the 18 days. And then Ula Shahba is a political activist, professional, who's a socialist, was part of the protests against the consolidating of power of the Islamist, not even a year before the end of the presidency of Morsi. Mm. And was continuously, she's a very politicized and very a leader in her party. Mm. So there are three different women, and I'm saying that because I want to also emphasize the complexities of those experiences and shahadat within the different contexts, and not to have people think that we're trying to generalize anything out of those shahadat. The other thing is that those women, because the three of them experienced three of those tactics of sexual violence against them, they represent not only women, they represent, as I said earlier, all genders, and they've kind of experienced that violence in different ways before the revolution in the public sphere. Mm. But this has become, you know, exasperated and intensified during the revolution. They are not unique in the sense, of course, we respect them for speaking out, for being quote unquote courageous, but all of them told me, don't call me courageous. Mm. It is about that moment where we know we the Egyptians were fearless. I mean, the people in the region were doing things that were not imaginable in that time period and the space of the revolution on the ground. So they were fearless because they were also pulling in and fed by the moment of fearlessness. Mm. So they're part of the context, and we don't need to, you know, individualize their experiences as they are heroes or exceptional. They continually told me, we're not exceptional. There are many, many women and men and other genders have gone through this, but they didn't speak out, or they spoke out and you didn't read it, Manal, or you didn't hear about it. And of course, that takes another project to look at all the shahadat to learn more. So the testimonies or the shahadat of the three women, Samira, Yasmin, and Ula, are detailed expressions of what happened to them almost moment by moment. Yasmin describes almost for me second by second. Mm. What happened to her in 90 minutes. Mm. As I asked her, she has expressed her shahada on several platforms, but when she came to visit me, she wanted to say more. And I said, if there was a camera following you, how would you describe it? And she described it visually, auditorily, and viscerally, but also she describes the smells around her.
Wow.
And she was also telling me about the time of it. She would say it must have been 7 something, or I think it was over at this time. She was like so detailed in it, and she wanted every single detail to be part of this text. So including those three are detailed and complex enough to elevate not only the experiences of those three women, but to bring us to focus on this methodology of resistance, mm-hmm. theorizing and knowing, and also, of course, resilience, and also bringing gender understanding to a different level in Egypt specifically.
So, you know, oftentimes when women's testimonies of sexual violence perpetrated particularly by authoritarian regimes in, you know, the Global South and in the context that we work in the Middle East and South Asia, when they're discussed by feminists, such discussions are attacked or silenced as they're said to serve imperialist agendas, whereby, you know, that then allows, you know, European or North American or white people and their armies to quote unquote go and save brown women from brown men. And so I'm just wondering in what ways these testimonies in your book both resist and defy imperialism and authoritarianism and capitalist patriarchal violence.
It's weaved throughout the book, showing the intersectional struggle against militarism, imperialism, specifically US imperialism, and patriarchy and heteronormativity throughout, and police brutality. And those people who don't have the stamina are superficial. They might look at this just from the title and think that, oh, poor Arab Egyptian women, right? We need to go and save them. But it's clear that I'm naming names that are of the complicit in the regimes after the revolution, and of course before, that are U.S. Compradors, they're U.S. allies. And the Egyptian army is almost a U.S. army. It's not separate from the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And the Egyptians know that. I don't need to tell them any of that. And the other thing that is in the book is, when I first met Samira, she told me, my shahada is online, go and get it, but I want to tell you something. I've been interviewed right after, when I was still in shock, of course, by so many Western journalists and academics. I have no idea what they wrote about me. But then I showed her one of the books, and I'm not going to name, that had represented her experience, part of it. And that representation was not accurate, if not harmful. And she was pissed. So she was saying, I was saying to her, that happens. And I explained why. And I said, my intention is different. My approach is different. So we continued our relationship. And I met her many, many times. I'm in contact with her often. And she, at the end of mid-2018, when I was ready to put everything on paper, I told her, don't you want to read it? And may I translate it to you? She says, no, I trust you. So at that point, we've had built that relationship of trust over this testimonial text, that I don't need to defend myself from the criticism of people who are not willing to read deeply into this work. I care about the trust of the people that I worked with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. So actually, Manal, returning to Shahadat and Haki, before applying this methodology for this work, you have been deploying it with Chicana feminists on the borderlands of the U.S. settler state in New Mexico, and have been working with feminists to develop pedagogies and methodologies of pláticas, haki, testimonio, shahadat, to contribute to decolonizing research in academia. I think the work that you're involved in is so important, it's so valuable, and the contributions, or I think what it really does is it contributes tremendously to feminist decolonial methodologies, particularly your work in relation to Arab and third world feminisms, as it is rooted in the epistemologies and ontologies of the region, you know? And so thank you for this gift, because I know, you know, just the way you were describing you coming into the academy and not having, you know, like these tools in your classes or in the work that you were trying to do at the time. Similarly, when I came to graduate school, you know, they were limited. I'm not saying there wasn't any, they were limited. And of course, oral history methodology has been used in the region for such a long time, and I use that a lot and draw from other people who've also really, developed these methods. But I just want to say thank you for that gift, because this is really important in advancing decolonizing methodologies beyond North America, you know, because a lot of it really is inspired by Indigenous feminists and Indigenous writers and researchers. But can you speak and tell us also about your collaboration with the Chicana feminists, where you are, and the process of developing these pedagogies and methodologies?
Yes. I also came in a bit late to Chicana feminisms after I became an associate professor. And searching and trying to do and figuring out my Arabia feminist methodologies. And I started to collaborate with two of my colleagues, Dr. Cynthia Bejerano and Dr. Judith Flores Carmona, and others across the borders to figure out what the academy is doing to us. Where is our epistemology? How is it sidelined if not murdered? And so we found out that we are all struggling, having the same struggles against colonialism, against militarism, against the apparatus itself, the academy that perpetuates colonialism, racism, and of course, sexism. So because we, in our little site on the borderlands, and all figuring out that we're in the same struggle, we realize we're also using the same kind of methodologies. Mine were not named, and then I started to search, and yes, testimonials, shahadat were used, but not named as a research methodology. Haki was beginning maybe to be named as a methodology, but they were not given legitimacy and value within the academy. So we began to work together in our own project, just divulging our pain and the violence of the academy on this borderlands within our university, which is land grant or land grab university and a Hispanic serving university, which didn't make sense because they were driving out all faculty of color, especially feminists of color. Okay, or they're having all sorts of obstacles within that kind of, you know, this space, this university. So finding out that we have a common goal, a common vision, and pulling all the methodologies that we know of together, we began to collaborate and write. So within the span of the past 4 years, we've published four, if not five, pieces together. And I'm about to do another one with Dr. Flores Carmona. But the issue is, it's with Dr. Flores Carmona, we realized that this is part of our pedagogy also. It's not that we're going to teach it as a tool only, but we enact it within the classroom. So it happened that we taught one class on revolutionary women. The second time I teach that class, and then it's just erupted that it is part of what we do as pedagogically. So it is not separate from the so-called research methodology. It is also a pedagogical methodology. It's a tool of collaborating, relating to whoever is in your classroom and wanting to learn and teach within that space. So I am actually very blessed that I came into this location, into this university, because it's on the borderlands, because it's constantly reminding us we are going through the same struggle. It's similar. It is so similar. The borders here are similar to the borders that put on the bodies of Palestinians by the Zionist Israeli state. And it's the experiences of people crossing over every day is the same experiences that I know of the Palestinians trying to cross, etc. So it happened that I am in this space, and we began to work together. And now we don't think that this methodology is separate. That's why we write the words together, testimonial / shahadat, and then haki / platica, so that we know, we show even the bridging and the collaboration together.
And actually, what as you were speaking, what really interested me also is when you were saying it becomes sort of embodied in the classroom. Can you give an example of how that happens? Like, is it in the dialogue itself as you're talking? Is it in, like, how does that happen in the classroom when it's being enacted or embodied?
Yes. For example, when Dr. Flores Carmona and I were teaching revolutionary women, we were bringing in text on Palestinian women, Egyptian women, and Mexican and indigenous women. So reading that text, we cannot escape coming into the classroom, the space of learning, without checking in with each other and saying, so-and-so, now that we read this text, can you tell me what your mind, heart, body, and spirit are feeling and thinking? So we begin the classes with divulging our almost testimonials and shahadat about the text, what that text, witnessing that testimonial by reading it, what did it do to us? So slowly, as we begin to build that relationship of trust with those who come to that classroom, a space of vulnerability opens, and somebody would say, that testimonial shahada opened this inside me. I remember this and that. I know this and that in my family, in my history, in with my ancestors. So they bring in their own testimonials and shahada. So there's no way around it if we are going to read them fully, reflexively, with our bodies and minds and hearts. Mm-hmm. So that's how they become one. Yeah.
Thank you. That's super helpful. So I also teach a course on revolution, and a lot of it focuses on the Middle East as well. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, these revolutions aren't, you know, these moment or uprisings aren't just these events or moments that happen. They're ongoing historically, sometimes for 100 years, sometimes even centuries. And so I would love to hear about how you're teaching about the Egyptian revolution, and if you can explain how you particularly use shahadat and haki, and then also graphics, because you're doing a lot of work with graphics to pedagogically teach about revolution.
So the example I gave just a moment ago is one way of answering your question, but I also teach the feminist research methodology class. That's not a requirement to anybody. So I have people enroll in it from different programs and as PhD students or graduate or undergraduate. So the way I teach it is I frame it as a decolonial feminist research methodology class. And we have to read what decolonizing research means in the academy. And we begin to look at methodologies that are decolonial and are decolonizing, which are two different things, but give examples, readings, whether articles or books, and artistic representations in film and otherwise, so that they see how that works throughout. So testimonial and or shahadat and haki are one of those methodologies. Mm-hmm. And the students or the learners in the class, they're just like, where was this methodology from us? And a number of the PhD students had to go struggle with their committees to argue the legitimacy and the value of this methodology in their dissertation studies. Right? So using it, I think I'm more confident now after almost maybe 2-3 years of teaching it. But also because I bring in my other colleagues to be guests in the classroom to show that it's not only me who's speaking on this or the text that I've provided you, but there are other people who are doing it constantly within the classroom and within their research. And so the more we teach it also, and we make it accessible within articles or books, and other forms of art, it will gain value and legitimacy, so to speak, within the academy. Though if you and I know, and you know more than me because you do resistance art, you know it is partly, you know, how people express their experiences. Art is a testimonial, is a shahada. And literature is in the, let's say, examples of that, Palestinian literature is full of what we now call shahada or shahadat. So it is the academy, that space that is so structured, so fixed, and so resistant to malleability and shifts, of course, for reasons we know, is where our struggle, my struggle is at this point. Although I feel doing the testimonials in an art form is the bigger struggle, so that it gets and it speaks to the bigger collective.
Yeah. I mean, I have so much to say about that, you know, but I will keep my comments brief. I think, you know, especially because of the rigidity of the disciplines, even though we do have interdisciplinarity in the university at times, it's, you know, because of people's disciplinary training, oftentimes part of that is around that it doesn't speak to a particular kind of disciplinary methodological training. Sometimes it's just colonial, in that people's minds are so colonized that these new kinds of methodologies are met with immense resistance because, you know, I don't know, they don't want to really grapple with this. And I think, you know, in my, especially men's scholars have said this to me at times when I kind of bring up decolonizing methodologies, is this is flaky kind of scholarship. And it's really offensive because the kinds of scholarship that we're doing is deeply about revolutionary processes, subjectivities, histories, and you know, the very people that say that they write them through these detached perspectives then produce and reproduce really awful narratives of these very events or processes that they claim to document. And as you mentioned, with the woman that you had worked with, who said, you know, she had shared her shahadat with so many Western scholars and journalists, and then the way it was articulated, I think because there is a disconnection between the ontologies and epistemologies of that place. So yes, you can study all of this in the books, right? But there's also something embodied in our knowledge production processes that I think Western academia, in the name of objectivity, really, you know, like, just kind of tries to remove researchers or knowledge producers out of. And I think, I've witnessed the violence of that a lot. And so I've just decided, like you, that, you know what, let the work speak for itself. And yes, very people that have talked about, oh, this is flaky, well, we'll see what is flaky. Yes. When you see what comes out, you know. So I think that we are doing work, I think, that I think is going to open up doors for another generation. I'm like at the entry point of that new generation. And I think there's a lot of exciting possibility of what is yet to come. Yeah. But speaking of that, you're also an incredible pedagogue, and you always think about how your research can be accessible to the broader public and community. And in your previous work, you have worked with Chicago's Silk Road Rising, a political theater and film company in Chicago, to translate your research in an animated film, The Four Hijabs, drawing from your 2012 book, Pedagogies of Devailing. And with this most recent book, you've worked with Egyptian artists to represent through graphics the shahadat and testimonies of the various women that are in the book. And so can you tell us more about this cultural work that you've produced in collaboration with the artists, and what the pedagogical purpose was for creating these?
So an extension of testimonials, haki, shahadat, and platikas is research-based art for me. I'm feeling right now, like, since I collaborated with Silk Road Rising and I saw the impact of the animation, it's not an option for me to just produce articles and books.
Right.
And it has to come out in a way that is visual, artistic, to speak to the general public. And my collaboration with artists in Egypt, and they self-identify as feminist artist was in another story. It was an incredible experience of each, how we selected. I connected with one of them who took upon her to select other artists who are close to the other testimonials, mm-hmm. and can represent them. And then connected with the three women, with Samira, Yasmin, and Ola, sat with them with the script that I gave them, mm-hmm. and began the process of visual representation, which took at least 6 months. So for example, the artist of Yasmin's Shahada had gone through the same experience. Mm-hmm. And they were friends. So you can imagine the synergy,
right,
that brought out the art from that artist. So that each artist had a specific connection, whether with the experience or with the person or both, to be trusted and to go within the process of sense making to put it out as a visual art, a graphic art. So, and for me, I was watching that process of creation as a process of theorizing again, because they made different assertions, claims about every specific piece of that Shahada. It's for another project. So my experience always, those two times with the animation and this with the graphic piece, it has been elevating and healing. When you do academic work, as soon as you leave, so to speak, the field and come to the paper and the computer, it is an isolating, almost damaging, violent experience, because I'm sitting with those shahadat and the violence in them on my own. I've sat with them since 2011, and it's hard. It is very hard. And the constant question, am I doing justice to those testimonials and shahadat? Whereas when I worked with the artist, there's a different space. Mm-hmm. There's an opening for imagination. There's a lightness, as heavy as this work is, there's lightness that comes with collaboration.
Right.
Through art. It's not the same as collaborating on writing. It's another, even though writing is a creative practice, this is another kind of creative practice that I long for in every piece from now on to continue to do. And it has, I want to say, it has a long life, more than an article and a book, a long life beside the wide, broader reach. Long life because an art piece can be represented in different ways. For example, the animation film The Four Hijab was first done in English by English American actors, then subtitled in Arabic, and this month we're launching the dubbed Arabic version. So it has, and it's been 4 years. So having a graphic representation of the Shahadat in Arabic and in English, we're still having had the platform to disseminate them because of the resistance of many publishers in the US, Canada, and in the Arab world, because it is exposing so many regimes and specific people even, and could put the artist in jeopardy and under and in risk. So, but I am saying that the artwork out of academic research has a longer life than a book and an article.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, now this, congratulations on such a huge, you know, body of work, both in terms of the book itself, the graphics that have come out of it, the collection of the testimonials and the shahadat, and the teaching of it, and the continued and sustained relationships that have come out of this work. Doing this work is never easy. It is. It comes with so much challenges. So much of this is also part of, you know, our political lives and histories. And so it's also part of our struggles. And so I just want to congratulate you on what I think is going to be, received really well, but also I hope gets attention despite the fact that we're in the pandemic. And, you know, I have a lot of questions for you also about how testimonials and haki and this kind of, you know, art and representation can be used in struggles for liberation. But I think that this conversation needs to be continued. And so what I'm going to propose is for us to have a second podcast episode, because I certainly want to discuss those things with you, but also talk to you about where things are at in Egypt today. As of course, you know, Assisi's still in power, and this is a regime that has also been so violent towards its people. And so I'm just hoping that we can continue that second conversation perhaps later in the year.
I would love that.
So yeah, so for today, I just want to say thank you so much. I'm so thrilled that this work is out, and thank you for being with us, sharing your insights. And it's just always such a pleasure, honor, and joy to be working with you and collaborating with you and thinking with you and listening to you. And yeah, so thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity and for doing this deep Platika Haki together. So it is. So I will be processing this, because I'm always in that mode of recognizing this. We have made different sense and different meanings out of this work together as we had this conversation. And I look forward to having another Haki with you in Platika. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.